Case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in United States against von Neumann. I think you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. The question in this case, in essence, is whether the Customs Service's routine administration of its civil forfeiture responsibilities violates the constitutional rights of persons whose property has been lawfully seized for violating the custom laws. Specifically, the issue concerns the effect, if any, of the Due Process Clause of the Fifth Amendment on the administrative consideration of a petition for remission or mitigation that is filed in connection with the seizure for civil forfeiture, here for failure to declare an automobile to Customs upon entry into the United States. Pursuant to 19 U.S.C. 1618, an individual who has an item seized for forfeiture, even if the item is unquestionably forfeitable, may file a petition for remission or mitigation with the Secretary of the Treasury, seeking to have all or part of the forfeiture remitted. The Secretary has set up certain internal procedures for processing these petitions. In the ordinary course, the agency will consider and rule on the petition, giving its ruling to the claimant. If the Secretary determines that remission is appropriate and the claimant agrees to the terms of the proposed remission, the matter is settled without a judicial proceeding. 95% of remission petitions filed in car seizure cases are settled in this fashion. If there is no agreement on remission, either because the Secretary determines that remission is not appropriate or because the claimant is unsatisfied with the terms upon which the remission is offered, then the case proceeds to a judicial or, for smaller cases, an administrative proceeding in which the forfeitability of the item is determined.
Mr. Horowitz, is the remission proceeding basically used as a statutory authorization to the customs people to just settle these cases? Is that what it boils down to? They have settlement authority, in effect.
Well, they have settlement authority. I guess in some ways it's used that way,
it
although they're not really
the
prosecuting authority. It is an agency thing. They're not the prosecutor. But settlement is part of it.
It just seems to operate as a practical matter.
Yeah.
As an agency settlement of a potential forfeiture.
Yes, I would agree that as a practical matter, that's basically how it operates. The reason I hesitate to agree completely is that it is possible to get remission even after the forfeiture proceeding has occurred, in which case there would no longer be a settlement. It would purely be a matter of executive grace there, but naturally the government is more reluctant to grant remission in those circumstances, and therefore it's to the advantage of claimants to have the remission petitions decided upon by the agency before there's been a judicial proceeding. The background facts may be briefly stated as follows. On January 20, 1975, respondent attempted to bring across the Canadian border into the United States a new Jaguar that he had purchased in Europe. When asked at the U.S. Customs Station whether he had anything to declare, he failed to declare the car, and it was then seized as forfeitable under 19 U.S.C. 1497. Respondent then completed, with the assistance of the customs agent on duty there, a brief handwritten petition for remission in which he stated that he had no intention to avoid customs duties. The customs agent then helped respondent arrange transportation to a local hotel where he stayed overnight, and from there he arranged to get home in his private plane that was waiting for him in Seattle. 2 weeks later, customs returned respondent's car upon his posting of a bond for the value of the car, assessed at $24,500. On February 12, 1975, approximately 2 weeks later, Respondent's Counsel filed a more detailed supplement to his remission petition. This was prepared by attorney for the respondent. 13 days after the filing of that supplemental petition, Now, 36 days from the date of the original seizure, Customs acted on the remission petition. It informed respondent that his penalty.
A difference between mitigation and remission?
I would say no. I'm using the term remission to cover both. Generally, remission, I think, may refer to remission of the entire forfeiture. Mitigation
or less,
is a partial.
Or less than.
Yeah, or less than.
Yeah. So mitigation is not less than.
Well, I think mitigation can also mean less than. Right. So.
When, at that stage, on these facts, in your view, could the government have justified forfeiting the Jaguar completely?
After it had acted on a remission petition?
No. Before they had there'd been any effort to mitigate or remit, on these facts, could the government have taken and kept this Jaguar?
There's no question that the government could have forfeited the Jaguar. And, in fact, the Ninth Circuit itself held that the Jaguar was forfeitable. So the only reason that respondent was not out the entire $24,500 is because Customs had agreed to remit some of the money to him as a matter of executive grace.
I'm interested in the same sort of question. Is there any explanation on the facts of this case why anything would be remitted? Can you imagine a worse violation of the customs law than?
Well, possibly. I can imagine a worse violation of the customs law. In general, customs. In most cases, Customs does grant some remission. Now, whether that's a reflection of their overriding policy to try to avoid as much litigation as they can, or just a recognition that the violation, the penalty set forth in the statute, can be a rather harsh one.
Seems to me this is a stupid act of generosity, but that's irrelevant to the legal issue, I realize.
Well,
isn't the predicate?
Let me just say it's not an atypical act of generosity on behalf of the Customs Service.
Isn't the predicate for a petition for remission that there has been a fine or a penalty imposed or that a forfeiture has occurred?
Well, the assumption of the remission petition is that the property is forfeited.
Isn't that what the 1618 says?
Yes, 1618.
And you have to say yes, I guess, for that.
The claimant doesn't have to concede forfeitability in filing his remission petition. In other words, if the remission petition is ultimately denied and the case goes to a judicial hearing, the claimant is still entitled to raise his defense that it's not forfeitable. He hasn't conceded that away. But for purposes of the remission petition, the assumption is that the property is forfeitable, because if it wasn't, there would be no need for a remission petition. He would be entitled to have his car back altogether.
But once you decide that it's forfeitable, then it isn't his property at all, is it?
Once it's decided in judicial proceeding that it's forfeitable, the government's car, and under United States against Stowell,
you can see
really was the government's car.
You can see that if he puts the forfeitability at issue, it has to be decided.
If he puts the forfeitability at issue in the remission proceeding?
Yeah.
Well, I think he's entitled. The Due Process Clause, I think, does guarantee him
So how can he put forfeitability at issue?
How can he put forfeitability at issue? He can do it by asking the government to bring its judicial forfeiture proceeding.
Well, may he do it in the remission proceeding?
Well, as part of his remission petition, he may be claiming that he had no culpability at all and that
may he put forfeitability at issue in the remission proceeding?
I'm sorry, Justice Wyman. I guess I'm not sure what you're asking. He can raise the claim that he doesn't believe
it is
forfeitable.
He files a petition for remission or whatever you want to call it, and he says, please remit because my car wasn't forfeitable.
Yes, but in raising that claim, he is entitled to the Due Process Clause, I think, entitles him to some sort of a judicial hearing or something like that.
So he may raise it.
He may raise it, but when Customs acts on a remission petition, it usually is not with the full panoply of due process protections that are associated with the judicial hearing. So I would say, if Customs rejects a remission petition because it has rejected his claim that the car is not forfeitable, that is not dispositive of the issue. He's still entitled to a judicial hearing.
Are you saying that he's entitled to some sort of a due process protection if he raises the issue of forfeitability in the remission proceeding? Or are you saying he's entitled to due process protection if he seeks a judicial determination?
Well, what I'm saying is that at the time his property is seized, he is entitled to a judicial determination of forfeitability at some point if the government is going to forfeit it. And I don't believe that by filing a remission petition, even if as part of his remission petition he claims that it was not forfeitable at all, that he has waived
Mr. Horowitz, there's no forfeitability procedure except in the district court, isn't it? Is that right?
For smaller seizures, it can be done administratively.
But let's take a larger one, like this one.
Yes, that's
$36,000 Jaguar.
Well, this was $24,500, and as it's
$24,000.
Well, today actually the limit is $100,000. So
whatever it may be,
this could be administrative.
Whatever it may be, if there is to be a judicial proceeding, doesn't the government have to initiate it?
The government has to initiate it, although the claim.
So if there's a remission proceeding, it's denied, then the government has to go in, if the government says it's forfeitable, and go in and initiate a proceeding in some court, doesn't it?
That's correct. The claimant can file an equitable action to get the government to initiate the forfeiture proceeding, but that's right. In order to ultimately forfeit the property, the government must initiate a judicial proceeding.
And this is in response to due process considerations, isn't it?
I believe so.
Well, it's in response to
due process.
It's in response to a statute, isn't it? That the government initiates a procedure? Is that just a kind of a constitutional?
Well, no. There's a statute that does it. I understood Justice Brennan to be suggesting that if there were no such statute, there might be due process problems, and I would agree with that the government is going to take property that at one time belonged to a private person and take it for itself and forfeit it. At some point, he has a right to be heard.
Let me go back a little earlier. Does this record show what facts were alleged to lead the Customs Service to exercise this compassionate authority?
As far as I know, there's nothing in the administrative file that reflects why the administrative decision was made.
Isn't it pretty clear that this record shows that from the outset he embarked on a scheme to defraud the government?
Well, it's not clear whether he had an intention to defraud it.
Well, isn't there a statement by him in writing that he was about to give this to his girlfriend?
Well, he says that he bought it for his girlfriend.
But there was a statement filed by him.
I'm not sure what that has to do with why he was bringing it into the country without paying the customs duty.
I thought the question was, did he make any statement at all? And you said none.
Well, he made a statement in his remission petition that he did not intend to violate customs duty. He had some story about how he had gotten lost looking for the Canadian customs station and somehow stumbled onto the U.S. customs station and had no idea what was happening. I guess I should say that it was only in a supplemental petition that he first made the claim that he really hadn't been given an opportunity to declare.
Well, it's understandable if a person makes a return and has a number of purchases and he forgets to list or declare a scarf or a book or some such thing, but a $24,000 Jaguar is a little hard to forget, isn't it?
Well, Mr. Chief Justice, I understand you'd be asking the question along the same lines as Justice Powell, which is you don't understand why the agency would send them a check for $21,000, and I understand why you're asking that. I would just say that they do have guidelines on these things, and this is not completely beyond the normal reach of the guidelines. They tend to be pretty liberal about it, or generous, I suppose, is the way to put it. With these cases, the respondent in this case wasn't satisfied with the Customs Service generosity. He was a little bit greedy.
But wasn't the problem that he thought he had to report it to Canadian customs rather than American? He allegedly got all mixed up. I don't know if it's true or not, but he did have some kind of an explanation.
Well, I don't completely understand his explanation.
If it was frivolous, you wouldn't have given him $20,000.
Well, the guidelines tend to go to first offenses and things like that. Generally, in the case of a first offense, they tend to assess a penalty that is somewhat less than the car. The duty in this case, I'm not sure exactly what the amount is, but it would have been something less than $1,000. So I think Customs has the view that for somebody to pay 25 times the duty is perhaps a little bit harsh.
And what they got was about three times the normal.
They got, maybe four or five, something like that. Well, so Customs did grant remission whether they should have or not, and they decided the penalty would be $3,600. They sent respondent a check for $20,900. After he filed an unsuccessful administrative appeal challenging the institution of the $3,600 penalty, he said, thank you very much. He deposited his remission of $21,000, and then he filed this lawsuit in district court seeking to recover from the government the $3,600 that he had not been repaid. Now, on the first appeal in this case, Court of Appeals held that he was entitled to recover. The basis for that decision was that the passage of time of 36 days from the time of his initial remission petition until the time the Customs Service acted on it violated his due process rights. And the Court added that the Constitution ordinarily required that such petitions be ruled upon within 24 hours. That decision was subsequently vacated by this Court and remanded for reconsideration in light of 8850. On remand, the Court of Appeals adhered to its prior decision that the delay here raised serious due process problems, although it retreated somewhat from its 24-hour rule and agreed that each case must be considered on its own facts. Now, it is our contention that the Court of Appeals erred in several respects. First and foremost, we submit that there is no constitutionally protected property interest at stake at the remission stage, and hence there's nothing to which due process rights can attach. Second, even if there is such a right, we submit that the course of events here could not conceivably have violated due process. And third, even if it did violate due process, we would contend that the remedy here, which is returning the $3,600 to him and basically eliminating the forfeiture, is quite inappropriate. The primary question here, the one on which I will focus, is do the protections of the Due Process Clause, which apply to deprivations of life, liberty, or property, attach to the remission procedure? Another way of putting the question is, does the remission procedure here, that is, does an adverse decision to the claimant in the remission proceeding deprive him of any property interest? We submit that the answer is clearly no. Of course, there's no question that the respondent does have a property interest in his car at the time it is seized. That property interest cannot be taken away without a judicial hearing. That judicial hearing is what gives him due process with respect to that property interest. But the property interest in his car simply has nothing to do with the remission proceeding here. The remission proceeding is collateral. It assumes that the property was lawfully seized. It assumes that the property is forfeitable. And the question in the remission proceeding is whether the government will give to the claimant either executive clemency or, as an act of settling to avoid litigation, whether it will give back some of this property, property that really belongs to the government, whether it will give some of it back to them. That decision does not deprive the respondent or the claimant of any property interest.
Well, Mr. Horowitz, it seems as though you reach exactly the same result if you acknowledge that there is a property interest in the car and it is subject to due process protections, but the forfeiture proceeding itself provides all the process that's due.
Well, that is our position, Justice O'Connor. Our position is that there's no due process right in the remission proceeding itself. Congress could repeal the remission procedure tomorrow, and there would be no question that the general forfeiture procedure would still satisfy due process. I think maybe the best way to look at this problem is to assume that Customs had set up the remission procedure a little bit differently. As we've explained, the remission proceeding comes first, the way it is set up now, and that is done to avoid litigation. But Customs could just as easily have said that the forfeiture proceeding will be held first. And let's assume that they held a forfeiture hearing the day after respondent's car was seized, and the car was held to be forfeitable. And then Customs said, now that your car has been held forfeitable, you can file a remission petition, and we'll decide whether we're going to remit some of the forfeiture. In that situation, there can't be any conceivable argument that there's a property interest or that any due process right would attach to the remission petition. It is the government's property. It's been adjudicated to be the government's property in a judicial proceeding.
And isn't the very point that that's not what the government does, that they haven't set up something where they have this procedure after the legal determination has been made? At the time this takes place, he still does have a property interest in either the bond or the car, doesn't he?
He has a property interest in the car, but it's not implicated at all in the remission proceeding.
But
the remission
proceeding is collateral. 95% of these cases are really settlement proceedings to determine who gets the car and how much he pays.
Yes, and just like any other settlement proceeding, we would submit that the litigant has no due process right in whether the government decides to agree to a settlement or not.
Your argument is if they had a different procedure, it'd be obvious. But my point is they don't have that different procedure.
But the question, what he is claiming is that he has an independent right to due process in the remission proceeding, quite separate from the forfeiture proceeding. The position of the Ninth Circuit, the position of the respondent, would
but
be the same.
Can we really separate them entirely? If 95% of them actually end up settling the forfeiture proceeding, why isn't it appropriate, as Congress did by putting separate, you know, statutes, why isn't it appropriate to look at it as all part of one statutory procedure for disposing of these controversies?
Because the question is whether the government's decision in the remission proceeding involves a deprivation of property in any sense. And the answer to that is no, because either the property is forfeitable, in which case it's not the respondent's property.
It's an interim decision in a proceeding which ultimately leads either to a deprivation of property or a refusal to deprive him of property. And it's a proceeding that takes place before the deprivation has taken place. And it's part of the overall procedure.
Well, that's true, but there are all kind of intermediate steps in the course of the proceeding. There's the assigning of a particular person in the Customs Service who's going to act on the remission petition. Wouldn't suggest that he has a due process right to be heard on who should be assigned to it.
Well, of course, it's a very separate question whether there's anything unfair about it, and I'm not suggesting that. But your position is they could be totally arbitrary, and they could give every fourth person would get a remission and every sixth one would not or something like that. That'd be perfectly all right.
It wouldn't be perfectly all right, but it would be perfectly constitutional. Yes, that is our position, and I think that position is correct, Justice Stevens.
Your proceeding if it wants to keep the $3,600 that it kept?
No, it does not. This is in the nature of a settlement of the litigation.
Well, then it seems to me that he has been deprived of $3,600.
Well, he's been deprived
as a result of the remission proceeding.
But he doesn't have to agree to the remission. He's been deprived of it in the same way that the person is deprived of his liberty.
What he's really done is given up the forfeiture proceeding, his right to due process in a forfeiture proceeding, by taking the $21,000.
Well, he's given up his right.
Well, isn't that right or not?
He's given up his right to a hearing on the forfeiture.
Well, he's given up his
any. He's
given up any right to have a due process hearing with respect to the government's right to $3,600.
But he's chosen to do that. It's the same as if there was civil litigation against the government and it never comes to trial. And
so he
settles
does waive.
His claim.
So he does waive his right to a forfeiture proceeding by taking the money.
By taking the money, yes, not by filing a petition. He has the choice of refusing the remission, but once he agrees, at least until this litigation, we would have thought that once he agreed to settle on those grounds, he was giving up his right to the money.
And
that's
was he
the point of the settlement.
When you sent him the check, did you tell him all these things?
Well,
looks to me
in light of this case,
that should have been your answer to his suit.
That was part of the answer to his suit.
Well, why aren't you claiming that up here?
Well, the district court never reached that. Thought it was a simple case, and
well, I know, but you could defend this judgment. I mean, you could say the judgment that the court should have ruled that there was a waiver.
We could defend. I suppose we could defend the judgment on that ground, but we're interested in. We're not that interested in the $3,600. We're more interested in the precedent of the Ninth Circuit, which suggests that unless the Customs Service decides all these cases with undue haste, we're going to have all these forfeitures thrown out of court.
Well, but the waiver, if that were the government's position, it would be a waiver of the right to have the government conduct a forfeiture proceeding, wouldn't it? I mean, that doesn't necessarily answer the question, is there a separate right to due process in the remission proceeding?
No, I agree, Justice Rehnquist. There is no separate right to due process in the remission proceeding. He has a right to have a judicial proceeding before the property is taken away from him. He can give up that right. It doesn't violate due process.
All I'm saying is that perhaps there are two separate questions. One is the right to due process in the forfeiture proceeding, which the government would institute, and second, a separate right to due process in the remission proceeding. And the fact that the remission proceeding is ultimately settled by a waiver of the due process rights in the forfeiture proceeding doesn't necessarily answer the second question. Was there a separate right to due process in the remission proceeding?
That's right. I agree. There are two questions.
The court had responded to your claim that he had waived, the case would have been over, wouldn't it?
Yes, the case would have been over. Well, no, let me take that back. His claim is that in taking 36 days to decide on his remission petition, they had already, by that time, violated his due process rights. So whether or not he had agreed to the settlement or not,
He took the money despite the delay. And I would suppose that's what you're claiming. By taking the money, he waived whatever due process rights he might otherwise have had.
Well, the question is, by taking the money, he certainly gives up the right to have a forfeiture proceeding. We ought to have probably stated at the time that he was also waiving any right to raise any other, bring any other sort of lawsuit in connection with this. But we didn't do that because I don't think it occurred to anyone that he could bring this claim. But the due process, what you're suggesting is that would not solve the problem that was raised by the Ninth Circuit's decision. Because under the Ninth Circuit's decision, he could have turned down the remission at the time and brought the same lawsuit and won on the theory that the 36-day delay violated his due process.
That may be
right.
So. That may be so.
That's what happened.
But if you won here on waiver, the Court of Appeals decision would never stand. The opinion would never stand. It would be vacated or reversed.
Yeah, but you'd get the same decision.
It would be vacated, but yeah, we'd get the same decision next time. We have the same decision in the Second Circuit in Johns against McKinley.
Anytime the fellow takes the money, he's out of court.
Well, but in Johns against McKinley, the Second Circuit case where they suggested there's Bivens liability, the man didn't take the money. Instead, he filed the lawsuit. And so we don't have this defense available. And he said that I think it was about 50
days. Well,
then
your answer would be that any right that he's got to due process is satisfied in the forfeiture proceeding.
Well, that's what our answer is in this case. And I think that's what the court should hold. I think I should reserve the remainder of my time.
Mr. Burke.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. I think the first question you asked, Mr. Chief Justice, puts this case in the proper framework. When you ask counsel whether or not the government has to justify a forfeiture, the government can make its forfeiture simply by administrative fiat or having seized the vehicle. That does not constitute a forfeiture. There is no forfeiture merely because there has been a seizure. There is no finding of guilt and there is no finding of fault. The only way that there is a forfeiture is not by the government acting unilaterally, but by a judicial proceeding which the government is required to bring. The government must initiate that proceeding. And I would respectfully submit to the court that as terrible as the facts may be, and my law professor said, argue the law if the facts are against you, they really are not your concern. The question posed by the Ninth Circuit and at issue before the court are the procedural safeguards that are involved when there is a seizure of property with no hearing. Not only is there no pre-seizure hearing, there is no immediate probable cause post-seizure hearing.
Well, Mr. Burke, there eventually is a hearing in connection with the forfeiture proceeding, and this court has determined that that proceeding has to be provided within a reasonable time to meet due process concerns. Now, but why isn't that all that someone in the respondent's position entitled to?
The reason is, Your Honor, that there is by code, by regulation, and by custom, one integrated procedure here, which I think you pointed out or inferred in your comments. As a matter of fact, the petition for remission is the very first step in one process, and the government has a vital interest in that, because 90% of the cases are taken off their docket and off their calendar. What is the expenditure of resources that they would have to do?
It's just like a settlement authorization as used before forfeiture, isn't it?
Your Honor, there's a difference, and I'll tell you, it is and it isn't, and the isn't is a key point. And that is, even though the person might not be entitled to a particular result from the administrative consideration of his petition, he is entitled to a prompt result. He is entitled to know where he stands because he's lost the vehicle without a hearing. And
well, in the normal civil litigation setting, why would there be some right to force the government to settle a lawsuit early?
The reason, Your Honor, is that in the normal, whether it be government or private litigation, there is no seizure of property without a hearing. As a matter of fact, this court in the 8850 case, and going back to the Pearson yacht leasing case, they said, we know this is an extraordinary situation.
Well,
here.
Suppose it is a matter of a dispute over property, which the government has taken, and there's a civil suit that arises. Is there some obligation for early settlement?
I think there's an obligation for this reason. It is established that there will not be a judicial forfeiture proceeding in 90% of the cases instituted until they've looked at the petition for remission. Now, if you have a due process right to a reasonably prompt hearing on the judicial forfeiture proceeding, and a precondition to the judicial forfeiture proceeding is the consideration of the petition for remission, you have to have a constitutional right to a reasonably prompt consideration of the petition for remission. Otherwise,
is the consideration of the condition of the petition for remission a precondition to the institution of a judicial forfeiture proceeding? Supposing that your client, when his property was seized at the customs station, wanted to bring about the fastest possible determination of his rights in the car.
He is led to believe, Your Honor.
Well, I'm not interested in what he's led to believe. What would he have done if he knew everything there was to know?
I suppose it would have been possible to, on the basis of what this court said in 8850, although I don't think it was particularly clear at the time, that he could have brought some motion under Rule 41E. I'm not sure about that, but certainly the court has strongly implied that. But I don't know that that would have done anything prompt. I think the issue, Your Honor, is promptness. And I do not know, and certainly...
But what you're talking about, all you're really claiming is the prompt right to a determination of the forfeiture, isn't it?
Yes.
If you can't prove that the remission proceeding is a necessary precondition to that, I think your due process argument is awfully weak.
Well, Your Honor, I would say that I prove it or strengthen it by the point that the government encourages this. In fact, it's even in the record. The government encourages the petition for remission as a means to the benefit of the government of getting rid of 90% of the cases. Now, if the government says to you, here is a structure, and as a matter of fact, Your Honor, it's been set up by Congress.
But if the government sets up a structure and says, we encourage this kind of settlement, and why don't you go through it? You say, it's just too darn slow for me. Why don't you go the way you want to?
Because, Your Honor, that's, with all due respect, totally unrealistic.
Well, but
it's
like saying that the government has to plea bargain by a certain date in a criminal proceeding, or like it has to promptly reply to a settlement letter in a condemnation proceeding. In a condemnation proceeding, the government takes the land without a hearing.
Your Honor, I don't think it's exactly the same because there is a whole panoply of different interests. It's not a question of an accused violation of a law. For this court to say that a man whose property is seized is supposed to make a determination of weighing what is the quickest procedure, whether the petition for remission is the quickest or Rule 41E, which of course he's never heard of, is the quickest. I submit where his property has been taken, and again we're talking about a taking upon an accusation only of a law enforcement officer, is not the kind of standard of conduct a government versus an individual, which is commensurate with a rule of law that should be operating in the country. I mean, Your Honor, it's obviously a question where people can disagree. At least I would hope that you would think so.
What did your client consider the $21,000? A gift?
I don't know what he considered it, but I think he never, I will say, never considered, nor was he ever told, that he was making a waiver. I think when he filed the petition for remission, he was advised...
Did he think that the government was just handing him $21,000 of my money?
Your Honor, again, what his state of mind was this. I would say that it is... It's fiction. What I would say to you is as much my guess as it is yours.
Speaking of fiction, I think, is about what you're doing.
But if you're getting into settlement, Your Honor, I think the implication of your question, if I can get the direction of the point, is the same as Justice White made, is that somehow this should be regarded as a settlement. However, what is the most fundamental principle of waiver of constitutional rights? It has to be knowing. You have to have advice. You have to have some notice being given to you that if you do this, there are consequences to it. And nobody in this record can point to anything that says that. I beg your pardon?
You mean we have to give him a lawyer?
But, Your Honor, no lawyer could have said that it's a waiver because... no case has ever decided that. If this court decides that that's a waiver, it will be deciding on an issue which was not pled and which has not been briefed and which, I respectfully submit, is not what the government took the case up all about on at all. There is no evidence of a waiver. A waiver is a knowing giving up of rights.
Well, didn't the government claim, in effect, a waiver in the district
court? In effect, what they claimed was a counterclaim in the district
court. Well, was it based on there was a waiver?
I think they based it upon a claim that there was a settlement, and it was not – the issue was never reached and was never taken up by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeal.
Well, that may be so, but do you think the government, either you or the government, can force us to make a constitutional decision when there's a non-constitutional basis for disposing of it?
I know I can't, Your Honor.
Well, the government can't either, can it?
Well, I believe, Your Honor, and I don't know what's in the government's mind, is that they were hoping, I think both parties here think the principle of law involved is more important than the $3,000. And so I suppose
that may be so. But still, if the district court had said, well, the case is over, this is a settlement. Now, you may have appealed, but it still would have been on a non-constitutional ground.
Well, Your Honor, I would say it raises, if you were to find in this case that there was a waiver, that would raise a serious constitutional question, and I believe that it would be a violation of due process. If you were to decide this case that there was a waiver on the basis of it is an encouraged procedure pursuant to a statute. Nothing in the statute says that there is a waiver. Nothing was told to this man when he filed the petition on a government form that there was a waiver involved. Nothing was told to him when they sent him a letter saying we're remitting that if you take the money, there's a waiver. It is not contained anywhere. And the back of the check doesn't say in full settlement of all claims. Now, that is four things that the government could and should have done if they're now going to come in and say there's a waiver. And for this court to rule as a matter of constitutional law that a party is bound or stopped by a principle of waiver when there has been no notice statutorily, administratively, correspondence-wise, or on the check that there is a release of constitutional rights, I believe is...
Well, I don't understand the government to be arguing it here. They don't want to argue it here.
Well, they don't, but I understood you were suggesting that the case could be decided on that basis.
No, not here.
Oh. All right. Well, then I missed to see the direction of your comment to me then.
Let me try to clear up a procedural question. Suppose instead of a $24,000 Jaguar for his girlfriend, he had concealed a $24,000 diamond necklace in his suitcase. And in searching the suitcase, they found it, and he has made a declaration that he had nothing to declare. Now, would they let him take the necklace along home with him, or would they take the possession of the necklace right then and there?
Your Honor, if they took possession of it, it wouldn't make any difference.
Well,
because
I'm just
he had
asking
a,
the fact,
they would.
Your Honor,
I would assume they would have taken
themselves.
The necklace the same way that they took the car. Okay. And they would have had a right to take it, because under the customs procedures, that was caused in the law enforcement officer's mind that there had been a violation.
And but if they didn't start the forfeiture proceedings in 36 days, you'd say that was a denial of due process, would you?
I would say it would depend upon the factors in 88 that this court enunciated in 8850. And the relative guilt or clearness of the guilt, the Second Circuit and Johns McKinley pointed out, is an argument for having less time than the 30 days, because they go through this in their petition for certiorari. They went through all of these factors, which they don't say they did consider, but they say they might have considered. And the Second Circuit pointed out, if guilt is so clear, why do they have to take so long? It is the limbo, if I may, Your Honor. It is conceding that there is no right to a particular determination. It is the fact that the man whose property is seized with no hearing. That is the basic fundamental stretching of the Constitution to the limit. The property is gone because a law enforcement officer thinks that there's grounds for a violation here. But there's been no hearing, no probable cause, no determination. So the worse the offensive makes no difference. The fact is that the person is kept in limbo. He doesn't know, do I hire a lawyer? Do I put up the bond for the full value? Do I go buy another vehicle? And what the Ninth Circuit and the Second Circuit did in their decisions in Johns and in the Von Neumann case was they said we have to look at this from the general standpoint of prejudice. And this, I submit, or hope, is a point that deserves careful attention. And that is, the facts of this particular case are not the most significant thing before the court. And as a matter of fact, the government hasn't treated it that way. The government's petition for certiorari contained the declaration of the customs official that wasn't part of the record. It's hearsay. It's like he was testifying before a congressional committee to make a rule of general applicability. And the rule of general applicability, which the Ninth Circuit and the Second Circuit decided, was what is likely to be the case in the most general type of circumstance. And that's what this Court is going to pronounce here.
Well, when the government has seized, whether it's diamonds or Jaguar automobiles, does not the when they've seized it and they're holding possession of it, does not the individual have a right to bring a McLevin action?
Well, as I indicated in response to a previous question, he may have a right if he consults a lawyer who looks at 8850. Of course, it wasn't clear then. That was 10 years ago. That he might be able to bring some rule a McLevin action. But the point, respectfully, Your Honor, is that it is the government's duty and obligation to bring the forfeiture proceeding. And now, as a matter of fact, it's codified that they have to act with reasonable promptness. And as a matter of fact, 1603 provides that the administrative, the customs people, have to refer it with reasonable promptness to the U.S. attorney. And once the judicial proceeding is instituted, there cannot be any administrative consideration of the petition for remission. So I submit to Your Honor that the emphasis or the key point here is the fact that you are dealing with what I've called the tipping of the scale or the stretching of the seizure right to the very limit of the Constitution, that it is, I believe Justice Brennan pointed this out to counsel, it is the government's duty to go forward. We've already said to the government, we're going to give you the greatest rights you can possibly have. It's an extraordinary situation here. You're at the very end of the spectrum of constitutional rights. You can take the property because it's a customs law.
Well, Mr. Burke, wasn't the tacit assumption of the court in the 8850 case that regardless of what happened with any remission, these are the limits that the government will employ in going ahead with a forfeiture? And we recognize in 8850 that there's a property interest to be protected. And I just have difficulty understanding how there should be an additional concern about timeliness of the remission. We were assuming, I think, in 8850 that there would, regardless of a remission proceeding, these are the outer limits that are to be dealt with in a forfeiture.
Your Honor, in 8850, by the way, at page 566 and 67, the Court did say unreasonable delay in processing the petition for remission could not justify prolonged keeping of the property without a hearing. And I think it's going to turn whether or not you essentially accept the proposition that it's one procedure and that you just can't ignore reality.
Mr. Burke, may the government initiate the forfeiture proceeding without having decided the petition for remission?
Well, if they do that, I think they have.
May they?
I believe that they may.
Do you know whether the practice has ever been to do that?
No, but, Your Honor, I'd like to ask the Court to probably feel that it's not that practice because they say in their petition for cert that they decide 85% to 95% of vehicle seizure cases on the basis of the remission. I mean, that's the applicable procedure that takes care of this. I mean, whether or not theoretically it is, the judicial forfeiture proceeding is the aberration. The way that these cases get decided is on the consideration of the petition for remission. And at least when they're holding the person's property without a hearing, and again, there can't be the judicial forfeiture proceeding in 90% of the cases without the consideration of the petition for remission. And if you have a due process promptness requirement at the last half, you've got to have it in the intermediate steps. Otherwise, it disappears. If the government did not, as a matter of practice, consider petitions for remission, and it was the aberration or unique situation, perhaps the point that you raise that, well, all we have to do is look at the timeliness of the judicial forfeiture proceeding is important. But that just isn't the fact. It's not the case.
But there's no requirement in the law that a claimant first go through the remission proceeding before he can enforce a judicial forfeiture proceeding.
No, that is right. And of course, the question is, well, is he invited? Again, we're almost in some kind of tacit waiver situation. He's not inviting a waiver. And I think that when Congress set up a statute that even though the agency has complete discretion as to what it will do, it says he's supposed to act reasonably, there's a statute on the books. And I would think this, Your Honor, I would say that, of course, you didn't reach this in 8850, but were there not a remission practice? And I think that there might very well be imposed a constitutional standard of a prompt probable cause hearing. I frankly believe that. I mean, you have never had to address that point. But if you're sitting in a situation where the man's property is seized without hearing, I don't think that the same standards which you laid down in 8850 you would perhaps lay down in the absence of the remission, because that was one of the prime factors, or a factor, that you discussed in 8850, was that the government had to have time to process the petition for remission, and that is one of the factors. If you did not have a petition for remission, I believe there would be a very serious question as to whether or not the government wouldn't be required within 24 hours or 36 hours or a very, very brief time to give a hearing. Certainly that's a requirement in any other situation, and why should the fact that it's a custom?
No, not a determination.
No, but a probable, essentially a probable cause, but something. Something other than the fact that a law enforcement agency has said, I think there's a violation here. I mean, it's still fundamental in this country.
What about the time when he's given the check? Could he have then raised all these points before taking it? You know, what does this mean by me taking it?
No, as a matter of fact, no, Your Honor, because...
Could he have then filed? Could he have filed?
He did. We filed in this case. It was not, this case does not come from a government forfeiture proceeding. It comes from a district court action initiated by Mr. von Neumann because he felt, at least, that he had been innocent and wanted to get his $3,600 back because he didn't want to be branded as a person who had violated the customs laws. And that was, to him, much
but
more
that was
important.
After he accepted the money.
Yes, Your Honor, but...
And couldn't he have raised all these things you've been arguing about?
No, because by that time, the due process had been violated.
Was somebody his hand over his mouth or something?
Your Honor, by that time, the due process right had been violated. What we he got a lawyer, Your Honor, after he filed the petition for remission. He got the lawyer, I think.
Okay.
That's right. But by that time, there had not been a determination. The question, Your Honor, about accepting the check and raising due process, I think, would perhaps have been perhaps controlling or more influential to what your decision should be if they had acted promptly and they had said, as the Ninth Circuit and the Second Circuit said, in automobile cases, decided in 24 hours or 36 hours because the loss of an automobile is a very important thing to most people. Now, it wasn't to Mr. von Neumann, but if you decide this case...
Yeah, airplanes too did.
Your Honor, if you decide this case on the basis of the fact that Mr. von Neumann wasn't as prejudiced as someone who was poor, then you are injecting a principle which is anathema to the Constitution.
You injected it. I didn't.
No. The point...
You
I believe...
Well, why don't you withdraw it?
Your Honor, I think I'm probably confused as to the point that you have said that I have said, because I don't know exactly what it... what point, if it's the time element...
I understand you. You're arguing that we have an obligation to do equal justice to the rich and the poor alike.
That's right. And it isn't often, I suppose, that a person... I beg your pardon?
We took an oath to that effect. Did you?
I only took an oath, I think, to do the best I can within the law, and I hope that I'm doing that, and I hope that nothing I've said raises any inference that I'm doubting at all what you're going to be doing and are doing. But I think the point deserves reiteration, and that is that we've heard... perhaps jocularly from the justices about the private jet and the girlfriend, and it was $25,000 and it was $36,000 and it doesn't make any difference. It doesn't make any difference if this was his truck and he was behind in his payment and he had to feed his family on it. That's why this case is before you, because the Ninth Circuit thought that way and the Second Circuit thought that way. And that is how I am asking you to think, to be bankbook blind, to say what is the general probable result of a situation where 95% of the time the government decides cases this way and it's a precondition, according to their own procedure, to getting into the judicial forfeiture proceedings.
You say a precondition according to their own procedure.
Yes,
you're not changing your answer that it's not a requirement.
That's correct. I am not.
Why do you call it a precondition
because
according to their own
procedure? Because as a
practical
matter, I think you cannot ignore the way things actually function as a matter of practice. And they are the ones who have raised that and have brought this before you. In fact, the whole justification for the petition for cert is the whole system's going to fall apart. We're just going to deny everything, to use their words, short shrift. Now, I don't think you can let them get away with that. I don't think you can let the government say we do this 95% of the time. But if you tell us that we have to act with reasonable promptness, and that's all we're talking about here, in the procedure that determines 95% of these cases, we're going to take the ball and go home. I don't think that Congress, when they enacted 1618 and told them that they have discretion to act reasonably, allowed them to do that. And I think the fact that they can decide the case however they want, which I'm conceding, of course, because it's true, without judicial review, makes no difference at all as to the time. It makes it easier for them. And they didn't make any showing or attempt to make a showing in this case that they did any of the things that they said would take so much time. And I think that's important for you when you're deciding this very case. In the petition, they said, well, if we got this thing, we would have to look and check whether he was a Swiss resident and the use of the car and did he register it in California. They didn't do any of that. And on the facts of this case, 10 years later, this should be put to resolution. They said this is a matter of executive grace. And I don't think it is. And they say, well, he's the same as a prisoner. And they cite those prison cases. But he's not the same as a prisoner because nobody has found him guilty. No court has said that he's liable. No probable cause hearing has been held. And I don't believe that this court wants to equate a procedure that is based upon a seizure of property without a hearing to a man as if he were a convicted felon. It's just not the reality. And that is the main point. And we're not talking about an estoppel to enforce the laws. There was the property was gone and it was lost. And I'm submitting to you that on a consideration, the issue of waiver is not here because the government would have had to put him on some kind of notice, which it never did by any means. And that as a practical matter, he had a property interest. The government concedes it. And if you're conceding there's a property interest and that there's a practice which, as a matter of practicality, decides 90% of these cases, And then there is, which comes before the judicial forfeiture proceeding, which is mandated and is the only thing that can justify the seizure, and there's no justification of the seizure and no loss of property interest until then in the intermediate step, the person is entitled to a final decision.
Is the due process issue here a time factor? Is that it?
That is totally.
What did the Court of Appeals hold?
The Court of Appeals held, Your Honor, that the test of the court in the 8850 case, the four factors which evolved from Bark-Wingo, is what should be applied here. The prejudice, the delay, the assertion of right, and the excuse for the delay. And it's not an earth-shaking case.
Didn't it give some advice about how much time would ever be permitted?
It was a step back, Your Honor. In the first von Neumann case, they said 24 hours was enough, and the Second Circuit had decided that in Levy-Thornton. They said a vehicle is so important.
Do you defend that?
I don't know because I don't have to. I'm not here to defend.
I know. Now what do you defend?
I say this, Your Honor. I say, first of all, that the court must establish that there is no loss of property interest upon seizure, which the government concedes. Second, given the fact that the person has an existing cognizable property interest and that his property has been seized without a hearing, he is entitled to reasonable promptness.
What is that?
I'm sorry.
What is that? Did the Court of Appeals have some specific period in mind?
No, that they left it to the I think there should be a 30-day rule for this reason. It's kind of arbitrary. One thing, it wins the case for me, which is, of course, the most important. But whether you took 30 or 45 or 60, there ought to be something because we're talking about conduct of the administrative agency, how they're going to act in the future. And the lack of certainty has been raised in some questions about whether the government officials know. So I think they should be told by this court, you should act, that there is a presumption that 30 days is enough. And then
when did the Court of Appeals think a presumption arose?
They said they left it to
5 days?
No, they did not say anything specific. The Court of Appeals said when the district court decides whether the length of delay is prejudicial, they should take into account that vehicles are very, very important in the general case to a person. His mobility, his livelihood, and they said when you're dealing with a vehicle, this was at the conclusion of the opinion, you have to recognize that a 30-day delay, I think they were inferring, and I think they should have just decided as a matter of law instead of referring it to the district court, because I think, as counsel does, they practically told the district court what to do here, and I think they should have done it. I think that they're saying, and that this court should say, something like 30 days is sufficient where you have a vehicle which can be, in the general sense, an extremely important thing. And there's, unless you can justify more, and that's the third point, which is your own test, the government should have to justify if they're going to take longer than 30 days, especially when they go on the assumption that he's guilty anyway, which is not the assumption that the claimant makes. And in this case, the reason I think this case should be resolved without remand is that they never purported to act with any constitutional standard at all. They admit that they said it was executive grace, and we're not acting with any idea that the man has a constitutional right. I think this court should tell the customs agents in the future there is a constitutional right here. Act within a standard. On the particular case involved here,
in somebody else's case, in a way, because your client had his automobile.
My client posted the bond for the 24.
Well, yes, so it's really, you're talking about being deprived of his money.
That's
for
that's,
more than 30 days.
That's right, Your Honor. But then that just has to bring me back to the argument. You're making a rule of general applicability. You don't look at the man's bank board and see how important was that 24,000. Maybe I could have presented a record. I wouldn't try to do it, but that this was the man's last 24,000. He had to have that car to make, you know, for his living. It's not the case, but you can't involve the administrative agency in that kind of proceeding.
But as if to you're how arguing about the, about a car, that's somebody. That's some other case.
That, Your Honor, no, it isn't for this reason. Well, I may allow to answer the question. It isn't, Your Honor, because you're getting into an implied waiver again. If you say you're not entitled to all the protections that you have when you lose your automobile because you post a bond, then what you're saying is if you post a bond, you're losing your due process rights.
Hold a car, but how long should the customs service in this case be allowed to keep this money?
I'm not certain that I agree with you because, again, you're saying he lost some rights by putting up the bond.
No, it's just
unless they told him in advance that there's
a
different standard.
It's just a question of applying Barker against Wingoda money.
In that case, Your Honor, that might be the case. The court might be instructed as one of the factors to take into account that the man posted the bond, and at least people...
You've responded to the question now.
Thank you. Thank you, Court.
Do you have anything further, Mr. Horowitz?
I'd like to make a couple points, Mr. Chief Justice. As I said at the outset, there is a property interest here, but that property interest is totally taken care of by the judicial proceeding. 8850 is what applies to that. If there's some probable cause question for the seizure, in 8850 the Court said he could file a Rule 41e motion. But the remission proceeding itself has nothing to do with that property interest. There is no deprivation of property involved in a decision on remission.
May I ask in that connection, just to be, because of a suggestion your opponent made, supposing you did away with the remission proceeding as you, and Congress hadn't provided for it, would you agree that in that circumstance there would be some kind of a constitutional requirement of a probable cause hearing at an early date? I don't know, maybe not 24 hours, but sometime soon.
Well, it would go to it would go to the probable cause for the seizure, I think, as to whether the item has been lawfully seized. I'm inclined to think that there probably would be some.
But anyway, the rule will take care of it, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think Rule 41, he covers that.
Well, either Rule 441 or presumably the remission proceeding may take care of it, too.
Well, now our position is that there's no prompt disposition requirement in the remission proceeding, so I don't think the remission proceeding takes care of it. And the remission proceeding doesn't go to whether the property was unconstitutionally seized. He doesn't have any right to any disposition in the remission proceeding. And when he gets a letter from the Secretary of the Treasury telling him what the outcome of the remission proceeding is, whether it's denial or an offer of a certain settlement or a certain figure, he's got exactly the same property interest that he had before he filed the remission petition.
But the statute says that the remission proceeding, if it was not willful, that's a factor that should be considered. I assume they consider that, don't they?
That's a factor that may be considered.
But don't they consider that?
Yes. Well, in practice, they do consider it, but they're...
Is he entitled to have them consider it?
No. Yeah. He has no right to judicial review. He has the right to petition for appeal within the agency, but if he's not satisfied, if he can come forward and show that someone in exactly the same position as him got a better deal out of the Department of Treasury, he's out of luck.
But could the Department adopt a rule saying, we realize Congress has said that the willfulness is an element, but we've decided it takes too much time to consider willfulness. We simply will disregard it and just consider forfeitability. Would that be permissible?
Well, I don't know whether it would be permissible under the statute or not, but that the question will be purely a statutory one. He wouldn't have any constitutional right for them to consider willfulness.
But would he have a statute? I'm just saying, earlier I thought you said that the statute imposed no obligation to consider willfulness. Then they could have a regulation saying, well, we just won't consider it.
Well, I say that the statute imposes no obligation for them to reach any particular decision. I'm not sure it even imposes an obligation to consider willfulness, but I'd have to look at it again. It just says if it was incurred without willful negligence, he may remit. If it's incurred without willful negligence, he may also decide not to remit. So I'm not sure that would violate the statute.
We won't consider whether it was willfully negligent or not. They could have such a rule.
I think they could. I'm not sure. But I think that doesn't have anything to do, really, with the due process question here, Justice Stevens. There's just no independent right in the remission proceeding to due process. I'd like to talk, if I have a minute, about this Rich versus Poor thing, because it's only a rich person like Mr. von Neumann who could bring this really ridiculous lawsuit. It's the poor people who have their items seized who don't really have an interest in the Ninth Circuit's decision here, because those are the people who need for Customs to decide these remission petitions and to give them back most of the property that they've had seized. And it's not in their interest to have people at the Customs Service looking over their shoulder at what is likely to be an invalidation of the forfeiture by the Ninth Circuit sometime down the road and acting on these petitions hastily. Now, we don't say in our brief that we'll give these petitions short shrift or that we'll deny them all if we lose this case. We do say that the due process clause, the Constitution, doesn't prevent us from doing that. And certainly in borderline cases, in cases where the Customs Service doesn't have the opportunity to investigate, they are going to be put in a position where they act on these things more quickly and less favorably to the claimants if they're concerned about 36 days being too long for them to hold on to one of these things. So I do think there is an interest that the claimants have in this case, but it's not the interest that is taken into account by the Ninth Circuit. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in New York.